Welcome to Gospel Tangents, the best source for Mormon history, science, and theology. I'm Rick Bennett. The ancient Israelites believed in a pantheon of gods. They weren't monotheistic. In our next conversation, we'll talk more about these Canaanite slash Israelite gods and learn more about them. We'll also talk about the Exodus and the walls of Jericho. Were Moses and Joshua real people? Did those events really happen the way the Bible says? We'll answer those questions in our next conversation. You won't want to miss it. Check out our conversation.
Hey, I just wanted to mention one more thing. The Mormon News Report podcast is an awesome podcast, and they cover the week in Mormon news with a healthy dose of snark and commentary. Join Brant and Jenny every Monday to get caught up on all those news stories that you can stay up to date on the latest Mormon news. So check out Mormon News Report. It's a great podcast. Brant and Jenny are great friends. Now back to our conversation.
We think that Deuteronomy was definitely written by somebody different.
Oh, yeah.
So we've got J, E, D, and then there's supposed to be a fourth author, P. Mm-hmm. So how do we get P out of all this?
Yeah, P is fascinating because, as some of your listeners will probably know, the documentary hypothesis pretty much reigned for 100 years. It was pretty much the explanation. We haven't gotten to Wellhausen yet, so maybe I should talk about him for a moment. All of that scholarship in the 19th century led up until the late 19th century to a guy named Julius Wellhausen. He was a German scholar, and he was the one who sort of synthesized all of that previous work into one system and argument to argue that there were those four sources. His argument was much more complicated than simply four sources. He couldn't separate J and E, for example. He identified J and E as having been edited together at some point, and he didn't spend very much time trying to separate those documents.
Well, so as I understand it, it seems like, I swear I always get these backwards, Jehovah J was used in the southern kingdom and Elohim in the northern kingdom.
So there are some arguments with that with Deuteronomy.
Okay.
But I don't know... you don't see that too much pop up too much in the literature about arguments of what came from the north and what came from the south.
Okay.
I think in the past, and I could be a little bit wrong with this, but I think in the past there was more of, and even 30 or 40 years ago, there was more of a push to try to understand, okay, what came from, you know, from Israel and what came from Judah and Jerusalem, and I don't know if. Many scholars still engage it specifically that way to say that, you know, yeah, it's possible that Deuteronomy was actually written up there during some of their reforms or something else, and then some of those scribes came down after the destruction of Israel, and, you know, maybe some sort of Deuteronomy, so an early version of Deuteronomy came down, and then that's what Josiah used. I'm not exactly sure about that, but as far as the J and E documents, there are arguments that way as well, that E would have been in Israel and J probably more of Jerusalem. But yeah, you don't usually see those debated too much now, partially because of the sort of shift over the last couple of decades in Pentateuchal studies.
Well, because from what I understand... When, you know, one of the big issues in the Bible was idolatry.
Uh-huh.
And so the Canaanite religion had a bunch of deities. You had uh-huh. Jehovah, you had Elohim, you had Baal, you had, who's the female?
Asherah.
Uh-huh. And so there was like this, you know, kind of like the Greek god Zeus and, uh-huh. and, you know, Jupiter and Mars and Venus and everybody. The Canaanites had this same thing, and so you had some tribes that were like, Jehovah is our God, no, Elohim's our God, no, mm-hmm. Baal's our God. And we've even got this story of Balaam, mm-hmm. who worships Baal, right?
Right.
And so, yeah. From what I understand, is they had to kind of decide, okay, well, who...
Yeah.
We're not going to be polytheistic anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Who is our God? And so it kind of, J and E kind of merged together. Is that a fair understanding of how that works?
Yeah, you're describing some scholarship, yes. So one of the one of the big issues with that is that exactly what you just described is the turning point with Josiah's reform. As far as the archaeological record is concerned, there's no difference between Canaanites and Israelites, for example. The worship of Asherah continued very popularly throughout Josiah's reign and well after. So that description in Kings, Samuel and Kings both, about this push against idolatry, is a much later, post-Josiah even, depiction of early Israelite history. You not only get the divine, God's name as Yahweh and Elohim, you also have Baal. I think it's in Hosea. Mm-hmm. And you have a handful of other names as
Moloch,
well.
Moloch, I think, is another one.
Right, yeah. So that depiction and that attempt to make it seem like Israelite belief wasn't tainted by all of these other polytheistic, right?
Yeah,
yeah. Isn't an accurate portrayal historically of what was going on. So as scholars have continued to develop their understanding of that, and particularly I'd recommend Mark Smith's writings on the development of monotheism within Israelite literature and practice. He has a lot of books, and some of them are more affordable than others and really approachable. So he's a great scholar.
Would it be appropriate, and I hate to use a political thing because then everybody's going to complain, but would it be appropriate to say Israelites and Canaanites were like Republicans and Democrats? Like they're the same people, you know?
Yeah.
Just one team versus the other?
Right. It's probably something like that to a certain extent because, you know, just for an example, I assume that some listeners will sort of bristle at my sort of quick, like, you know, the archaeological record says that Canaanites are Israelites, right? Because that goes against everything.
Against biblical literalism, that's for sure. And I'm sure I'm going to get comments from our little ones.
Right, yeah. So one of the really fascinating stories, of course, with them, going back a little bit further than that, but it's still within what's called the Deuteronomistic history. So 2 Kings is toward the end of the Deuteronomistic history. Joshua is at the beginning of it. So you not only have the Torah, the Pentateuch, but then you also have the Deuteronomistic history, excluding Ruth, if you're going with the Old Testament. But in Joshua, you get a really famous story about the destruction of Jericho. And for Jericho, it's when the Israelites are finally coming in and fighting off the Canaanites and purging the land, they come up to this great walled city of Jericho. The walls are massive. They're all around the city, and they're told to basically lay siege and then walk around it for 3 days. And on the third day, the trumpet sounds, and then the walls come crashing down. And then they go in and take over the city. That's a fascinating story, and I love it. Joshua and Judges are both some of my favorite texts to read in the Hebrew Bible. But the archaeological record doesn't not only not support it, it argues against it, unfortunately. It's a story. So sometime centuries after that...
The walls didn't fall down? Is that what you're trying to tell me?
The walls were never up.
There were no walls.
There were, but it only covered half the city.
Oh.
So in the 1960s, when archaeologists finally made it to Jericho and had the funding and the people to be able to go through and actually do a full look at the full city, they realized that the wall only covered the one side of the city. And they were surprised by that, particularly with the significance of the walls, you know, in the biblical record.
Because they're supposed to walk all the way around.
It's supposed to be completely covered, right? It's this great walled city, something that you can lay siege to. You can't get in it just by walking in, right? And so...
Was it just the southern border wall like Trump wants?
Yeah, something like that, yeah. The funny thing is, the purpose for the wall was to gather water.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was a hill on the other side, so when they had a rainy season, the water would come down and pool against the wall. So it wasn't a defensive wall at all. It was just to have water.
Wow.
A life source. So centuries after that had already... Jericho was... I should say it this way, sorry. Jericho had already been destroyed and was in ruins before the conquest narratives would have happened according to the biblical chronology. But even centuries more after that, you have some Israelite authors that are aware of the ruins, aware of the name, aware of the different geographical locations, and they're telling stories about how great their ancestors were in defeating the Canaanites. So these Judean authors, Israelite authors, are trying to portray their history as something other than Canaanites. We want to push ourselves away from that.
We're not Republicans.
So, right.
Or Democrats. Or
whichever it would be.
Whichever you want
yes.
it to be.
Yes. Yeah.
We're the good guys.
Yeah. The Tea Partiers. Yeah. No, I'm just kidding. Yeah. So, whatever it would be. They're writing, you know, stories centuries after the fact.
And so they see these walls that are ruined and they make up a story.
Mm-hmm.
So, let's see, Joshua wouldn't have existed then? Is that what you're trying to tell me?
That's part of it. that's where it's kind of funny. That's where it gets more difficult. And even in current scholarship, there's still a debate going on. There's a series of really good videos that were out of the University, I think it was the University of California, San Diego, back in 2013. And the whole conference is on YouTube. But that sort of still represents where scholarship is at on the question of whether or not the Exodus happened. A lot of scholars don't think that it did happen because they're just really, it's not that there isn't evidence. The majority of the evidence just doesn't really support that. And then particularly when, archaeologically speaking again, in Canaan, there isn't a massive influx of population at the time. There are a handful of just different issues that really don't support that. And if you don't have a historical Exodus, do you have a historical Moses and Joshua? Because that's sort of a key narrative turning point to each one. And to make it even more difficult, similar to what we have with Deuteronomy, where you can point to the vassal treaties of Esarhaddon as literary precursors to the stories and some of the laws and the language in Deuteronomy. We also have that with Exodus 2, with Moses' birth story. So Moses, I'm sure everyone is familiar with his birth story. Mm-hmm. It's very similar to the birth story of Sargon the Great. And Sargon the Great was actually 1,000 or more years prior to the 8th or 9th century BCE, when some scholars think that Exodus 2 might have been written. It's probably written after that, but some scholars go back that far. Sargon II, this Neo-Assyrian king, was obsessed with Sargon the Great's stories, even though it was 1,000-plus years before him. So he had all of his scribes recopying all of Sargon the Great's stories. It was very, very popular. And part of Sargon the Great's story was about how he was born a lowly birth. He was put in a little basket in the Reed Sea, and how he was found that way, and sort of that's the beginning of his.
So Sargon must be Egyptian if we're talking about the Reed Sea, is that right?
No.
As opposed to the Red
not
Sea,
the
it's the Reed Sea.
Yeah, not the Reed Sea, capital R and S, but A Reed Sea.
A Reed Sea,
yeah.
Okay.
It talks about how the little basket gets caught in reeds as well.
Okay.
Yeah.
So is this Egypt or then? Or
Assyria.
Where? This is in Assyria.
Yep.
Oh, so this is north of Israel, not mm-hmm. the south. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep. So a lot of the literary influence is coming from the north in that way. A lot of literary influence is coming from the south as well, from Egypt, and but that's in a different way. So you get some of that in Proverbs, Song of Songs.
Oh,
those
I didn't
kinds of
think
things.
We were going to take apart the Exodus story in this conference.
Yeah, yeah, it's a big
it's
part.
Some I've actually wanted to cover. I expected. That's cool.
Yeah, big part of the documentary hypothesis in a way, continuing scholarship on it, because again, you're finding well after those scholars had been arguing, it's probably not likely that Moses could have written by himself Genesis 1 through Exodus 1 or 2, because how could he have known that? He wasn't a witness to it. And some people might sort of respond like, well, Revelation. It's like, yeah, maybe. But historically speaking, though, These guys in the late 18th century were really trying to grapple with how could he have really like rationally known that. Mm-hmm. And it would have, you know, they would have been open to revelation as well, but Jean Ostrich and others found evidence that, you know, there were at least a couple of different texts that were compiled together.
I hope you enjoyed our conversation with biblical scholar Colby Townsend. In our next conversation, we'll talk about another type of biblical scholarship we haven't talked about yet.
That was through the influence of form criticism. Form criticism is another tool that scholars use to try to understand the history, but also the purpose of why texts are written. What sort of purpose in real life would they have had for the author and the audience?
If you'd like to hear the entire interview uncut, please subscribe to patreon.com/gospeltangents. And for just $5 a month, you can hear the entire interview without any interruption. If you'd like a paperback version of our transcripts, go to amazon.com and do a search for Gospel Tangents interview. Also, if you'd like to give the money to me and not Amazon, please subscribe on my website, and I'll be able to send you a transcript as soon as they are completed, and click the subscribe button. You can also find our latest information on facebook.com/gospeltangents, as well as we're on Twitter @gospeltangents. And don't forget to subscribe on Apple Podcasts. The link is at tinyurl.com/gospeltangents, and you can subscribe there. Also, please give us a 5-star review. If you want to support all of the podcasts as part of the Dialogue Podcast Network, go to lyceum.fm, that's lyceum.fm, and do a search for Dialogue Podcast Network or Gospel Tangents, because, you know, that's a pretty cool one, too. Thanks again for listening. Click here to subscribe, here for a transcript, and over here we've got some of our great videos. Thanks again.